Danke. Okay, I guess I'm just going to start anyway. Could you, when you leave, could you maybe close the door? Would be nice. Thanks. Okay, so I'm Holger Krickel from the Mellanox GmbH, and I'm going to talk a bit about free and open source projects going for European funding. But first of all, I'm very interested to know how many of you are actually involved in free or open source projects. Can you raise your hand? Okay, because I especially want to, I mean, the idea is to give some idea, to give some guiding and also some help for actually, if you want to go for funding yourself or are thinking about this in the future, then I think there should be a lot more collaboration and information exchange on how to do that. And that's why I'm going for this topic. So why am I saying that, why am I talking about hacking in this context? My understanding of hacking is a bit broader than maybe used at other places. For me, hacking is the art of understanding and also tweaking a formal system, which can be anything. It can be laws or can be computer code, whatever, and even bikes. I mean, you know about the bike hack that happened here, or hacking phones, whatever. I think it's a way of actually understanding of how a system, especially formal system, works, and then trying to find holes, trying to find ways to deal with it. And obviously, hacking is not always good by definition, although many here in the conference may think that or have a notion of hacking that is more positive, or so-called white hat or something. But, well, there are of course many illegal ways to deal with formal systems, and also of course with the European Union. So, free and open source is interesting. I think I got to it some 5 to 8 years ago. I quit from working for banks and all this because I wanted to go for a much more challenging environment and collaborate with other people from very interesting projects and people that actually knew a lot more than the people I worked with in the company. And that's really on a personal level. It's a very interesting challenge. Some of you may know the feeling that if you come somewhere and work somewhere that you are one of the persons who knows the most about certain stuff that is going on. But once you get to free and open source communities, you notice that there are lots of other people who know a lot more than you, especially in some particular fields. So, and another interesting thing is, I think it's becoming more apparent every day that well, free and open source projects obviously shape a lot of the information infrastructure. They are the main web servers, the main mail servers. The whole internet is actually driven, what many people don't know, especially end users, is driven by free software all the time. So the whole network that we have is actually an infrastructure that's based on collaboratively working together. And of course, and that's the connection point here, governments and the European Union are increasingly aware of what is going on in these and the importance of free and open source projects. So, EU funding is interesting because they have large research and development funds. I'm going to mention how much actually in the next slide, and. Of course, free and open source projects usually, as they are organized over the network, are internationally organized, which is one precondition for applying for any kind of EU funding, that you have to have multiple countries in there and have to have a group that actually can collaborate in all this. And obviously, free and open source projects are an excellent starting position for that, because they usually already collaborate in an international way, so that is not any barrier, and they're used to communicating over various channels, so that works. Now, the next things I'm going to mention, I'm not going to give any URLs, but instead I use italic terms for all the terms, and I verified that actually, that you can enter into Google, and they will get you to very good web pages. Usually the first hit is already a very good resource for the italic terms I'm mentioning in the next slides. I'm not going to talk very much about the PyPI project itself, where I'm coming from, which is a Python implementation. I'm going to drop a few words about this, but not that much, because I'm really talking about how free and open source projects can interface with the European Union. So let's get straight to the meat, the EU Framework Program 6. That is the program, the research and development program that the EU does in the range of 4 years from 2002 until 2006. And of course, after that, there's going to be the Framework Program 7 for another 4 years, with probably slightly different rules, but largely based on what I'm going to talk about. They spend 17.5 billion euros in German, that is Milliarden, which is 17,500 million euros. So it's a lot of money that the EU spends there in all kinds of different programs, of course. And the usual way how you go to the EU is in the form of collaborating groups, and they call that consortiums. These consortiums, like a group of organizations, submits so-called proposals that respond to specific calls. And these calls are issued by directorates. So you have this whole EU, and they are like, the whole organization is has lots and lots of directorates and sub-directorates, which are kind of like units that you that deal with a specific issue, like network security and all this. And they ask for, they set up a call, set up a deadline, and you as a consortium get together and make a proposal meeting this call. Then after you submitted your proposal, this is peer-reviewed by technical experts. They are usually independent. You can actually apply to become such a technical expert, and I think it's actually an interesting thing to think about for free and open source communities at some point, to send people there. And they give all the proposals points according to pre-stated criteria. They are weighted criteria, and you get points for each of the criteria according to your proposal. And then, of course, if you have one of the highest scores, then the most points, then this is usually then you're usually elected to enter the so-called negotiation. Negotiation means that the consortium talks to the EU, usually in the form of one representative, which is the project officer, and they want clarification on issues, they want that you economize your work planning, whatever. You will find out if you enter that phase. And the good point is that, as far as I know and as far as people told me and what we experienced ourselves, is once you are in negotiation, you get accepted, you're quite likely to actually get your contract signed and get the funding. So what does it mean to deal with the EU? Obviously, the EU is one of the largest bureaucracies in the world. And that means every step you make, every move you make is a formal procedure. But actually, I'm not really that negative about bureaucracies. If you compare that to like federalism, where you just had some king deciding things, bureaucracies have at least criteria, and you can have at least formal procedures to resist something. If you just have somebody ruling, it's not really that much better. So maybe going so bad at bureaucracies is not really that good of an idea. And actually, if I compare that, because I was saying hacking, if you compare dealing with the EU, having all these formal procedures, with an application programmer interface to, for example, for the whole Win32 world, or for this whole Java Enterprise stuff, or even Zoop, then I am not convinced that these interfaces are really better than the EU interface. So the EU has bureaucracy, it has formal procedures, but overall, they are manageable. and understandable in some way, and there are not really that many. I mean, there's some you have to take care of, and there's like some hundreds of pages, but if you look at all of these other frameworks in the programming world, they are a lot larger, actually. So let's go by example. Let's go through the process that my project, the PyPy project, went through. Took about 1.5 years from conceiving the idea to actually getting the deal. A few words about PyPy. It got started on a mailing list, actually, in a discussion on the Python DE list in January 2003. And three people who are quite engaged in different parts of the communities in Python, they invited to a first so-called sprint, coding sprint. And this took place in this nice building down right, obviously in the winter, and attracted some 12 people that came from different countries already. I think it was Italy, Sweden, well, Germany, obviously, Switzerland, something. A sprint, you may have heard of that, a coding sprint, is a way of meeting developers, usually involving multiple days, like a week. We are almost on the verge to doing 10-day sprints now. And it means pair programming, sitting together with two people in front of screens and writing lots of tests, automated tests. And that means that you can easily change your program in the future, and that allows for many more people to actually interact with the code base in a very nice way. And also what it means is once you get into this kind of hacking, that you perform some kind of egoless programming. And that's actually a very interesting topic. You can find more about this. It's an Italic term. You can find more about this on the C2 wiki. And of course, after all, I mean, usually you just you meet at mailing lists, IRC or whatever, maybe sometimes at conferences, but being together for a full week, eating together, having beers and all this, of course, gets you get to talk about a lot of stuff also on the personal level, and you can reach out for larger goals because you can actually conceive something. One word or one slide about what PyPy actually is. It already is a novel Python implementation. Python is a language that is used, I think I read in a recent survey, by 14% of the developers in the world. What we are doing is we are implementing that in Python itself in a very high level language and translating this to C and assembler directly. And we are using parts of our own interpreter to actually get to these low-level languages. So that's why I'm calling this the Münchhausen approach, which is, you know, the guy who got himself out on his own hairs. And one of the things we go for is we want to have Python has a virtual machine, very much like Java with bytecodes and all this. And we want to go for, but Java, for example, has a strict memory model and a threading model and all this. It's all set. And one of the research and development goals is to have memory models and threading models and all this completely configurable, which is of interest to embedded environments and gaming engines and all kinds of stuff. And of course, we also go for just-in-time compiler and some other more experimental features. So, what happened on our third meeting in 2003, first was in January, second was March, Göteborg or something, and then in June in Belgium, we got together and two people of our group began to push for the idea of PyPy going for a research call from the EU. And this specific call from, I think it was the Directorate D Unit 4, all these units have special addresses, how you can actually get to them. and this specific call was going for the following five points. One is open development platforms for software and services. Another was cognitive systems, embedded systems, applications and services for the mobile user and worker, and cross-media content. Like I said, for every call, this changes, these objectives, but they're reasonably broad. So you can actually, usually you can find something that may meet your project. So what we did is, that happened in June, and well, then there were holidays and all kinds of stuff. So from September, we actually decided to really go for this call. Also, in the meanwhile, we talked to people who have done EU projects, although not in the software area. And we worked quite a bit on writing the proposal. And by that, because you have to present work planning and all kinds of stuff, have to present your research ideas and what you're actually getting at. We tried to find out what we want to do ourselves, actually, in the next 2 years. And we tried to find out what the EU wants to hear, because it doesn't make sense to just present what we like if the EU doesn't like it. What we did is we just reused our coding process. So we had a collection of text files for all these chapters, and they were all under subversion control, version control system. And we used mailing lists, internet relay chat, generated HTML automatically from the text files, and that was always visible, so people could easily point other people and say, well, please review that, especially people from other EU projects, can you just review that and give us some comments if it sounds good to you, if it's really what you think the EU wants to hear, and so on. And this coding a proposal approach was actually very much done like we do our sprints. So people got assigned some tasks, usually pairs, who then peer reviewed each other. For every change to every chapter of the proposal, we have had diff notifications. That means that you could see who changed what, especially if it relates to work planning of, for example, your part. I mean, if you have some part on the project and you say, okay, I'm going to do this part, and somebody else changes it, then you want to know, of course. So in like 10 to 14 days, we wrote that proposal, which is not that much time. But of course, some of us had already talked a lot to other people before, and we had to find out a lot of stuff to actually make this happen. But there are templates, and you can just do something similar in your project, so I think by now it's even a bit easier, so it may not be such a big effort actually to come up with a proposal and see what happens. And then the deadline, we just met that, I think 2 days before we finished or so. That was on the 15th of October 2003, last year, October. Okay, let's get to some basic concepts of EU funding. They, of course, have a large vocabulary of things, how they describe what they are doing, and it's a bit alienating. You probably have not, I mean, for example, they talk of different instruments, and when they talk of instruments, I think they mean we as the EU are deploying instruments to reach strategic goals. So your project actually is a certain instrument or follows, has a certain type. Well, in programming language, I would say it's kind of a type. And our type of a project is a so-called special targeted research proposal, which is a very common one. I think it's used by some 50% or so of all the projects. It's usually in the range of, well, 1 million to 2 million euros of EU funding. And it's not that large, usually. And that makes it feasible, I think, for open source groups to use this model. And I mentioned the strategic objectives that the EU wants to see happen. And we went for the open development platforms and services one. And for software, I presume that whoever is going to apply for any kind of funding or so is probably doing it for software-related projects. And that means that you probably have to deal with the Information Society Technology General Directorate. That's like kind of the head of all the software projects and that they have various subdirectorates. And to see how this fits, this is, I think, the directorate that is responsible for us, Directorate D Unit 4, what I mentioned earlier, that issued this specific call. And that is their simplified model they offer on the web page, how they view the world. And what you'll see is free and open source software is already a component they have like as one of the major things in their picture. Well, it's arguable why complex systems, I mean, free and open source software are obviously also complex systems that, so this distinction and, well, you may argue about this model a lot, but looking at those pictures gives you usually some ideas of how the people that you're dealing with at the EU look at things. And it does make sense to use their vocabulary. Just as much as if you talk to a Java program, it makes sense to talk in Java API stuff, right? So it's just a matter of protocol and using the right terms to actually interact with them. One thing that is, well, I think a bit alienating actually also is the role of the coordinator. The EU wants to have one contact person. There's one contact person and it doesn't want to speak to anybody else. So it's a single bottleneck where all the communication that you do, all the formal procedures that you do, go through. Single thread, no possibility to directly phone someone in the EU to find out about something. It's always you have to follow this path. And the coordinator is, for that reason, it's very important for the EU because it's also the person where they send the money to, usually even up front. So the coordinator distributes the money later. And so they want to have this person, a very credible and preferably from a large organization that has already done EU projects, which of course, I think, brings up a lot of organizations that specialize in having these coordinators. And if that's a good thing or not is debatable, certainly, but that's how it is at the moment. And I think from the free and open source view or from the project view, it's especially important that you have a very reliable person and a very communicative person that has to make everything transparent that happens. For example, even up until today, I have no clue if the EU complains about something to the coordinator. The whole project has no means to find this out. Because if the coordinator just doesn't communicate this, then you don't know. So he makes a mistake, then you says, well, you did a mistake and this and that, you may never know. And there may be problems, but you cannot interpret them. So that's why I think this is important to get right and get a person that you rely on and who can really communicate in both directions and is open even if he or she makes mistakes. What is also good to know is the EU representatives, and there's also email communication that, of course, can get forwarded to the project, but they are very, very careful actually answering any kind of questions. So, and I found out at some point that the reason why they are very, very careful is that since a couple of years, they are made liable personally, the person you talk to, they are made liable personally with a 2-year salary if they communicate anything that leads to damages later. So if they promise you something or say you can do it this way, and you do it this way and you don't get the project or there's a problem later, you can sue. And if you do that and you win the trial, then this person has a problem. And this means you never get any, or almost never get any written answers. So you send in written questions and you get back a phone call, if even that. And well, that's obviously kind of very difficult. And the person, the project officer you talk to is usually a person that will take a long time asking the several departments in the bureaucracy that they make a statement, because then he can simply forward the statement and is not reliable. is not liable. That's obviously a very tough problem, actually, because you do have questions on all these rule systems, and the most direct way to resolve them is not really working. So what you can do, and that's very important advice, you can talk to your national EU office. In every country, all the governments are very interested to get as many participants as possible from their country receiving EU money. So you have that in Germany. I think they have some 10 to 20 people, lawyers, all kinds of people. You have that in Sweden and France especially. They're very big. But even in smaller countries, you have that. Netherlands, Belgium, I know that they have EU offices. And they are very helpful because they are there to be helpful to get the money into the country. There are even, I know in Germany, in Lower Saxony, there is from the region, Niedersachsen, there are even banks that if you get EU money, they even put something on top, right? And all this kind of stuff. So it does make sense to really look for your national and your regional institutions that can advise and support you. And this advice is actually very important because making mistakes in proposals or procedures can go very bad at you. So what happened to PyPy? We submitted the proposal, I think, in October. And at the end of the year, or early next year, 2004, this year, they notified us that we got 26.5 points out of 30. Basically, I think we lost some 3 points or so, not on technical merits, but because we were not mobilizing resources effectively, right? So we were not mobilizing resources effectively, which basically translates to too expensive. okay, but that wasn't such a problem because we still got into the negotiations. And they demanded some technical clarifications that we were able to, we actually traveled to Brussels for half a day. And the technical clarifications were easy to do, just like in the meetings, basically. But they also demanded large changes in our consortium, in our group of organizations talking to the EU. And that affected half of the people who were in the project. And that is obviously difficult. And the main two things, and you don't have to find this out the hard way, freelancers are a problem in some ways, and non-profit associations are a problem. Non-profit associations, there are non-profit associations, the German Gemeinnütziger Verein or Verband, that can get funding and they can get even full funding for what they are doing. But the EU is very restrictive about allowing such organizations, especially if this association has no employees, which was the case in our association. So they basically reject that. And three people were to work through that association, didn't work. Freelancers don't work. Well, actually, it's funny because we did ask our project officer, well, what about freelancers? And he said, well, no problem, just go for it. What he didn't mention is, what he didn't mention is that freelancers can participate, they can become members of a consortium. So his answer was true, but they don't get any funding for their work. They only get travel costs and accommodation if they travel somewhere. So he was formally right. And that, I don't know, I think that alone cost us like 2 months. That's why I said, I mean, talking to the EU is really can be very difficult in that respect. Okay, but still we were talking, we had these large changes, so it may be good to make up some guesses of why we succeeded. Well, we actually do have, and if you are in the virtual machine language business, then you may recognize that, what I said earlier. We do have some ambitious goals that are relevant because Python is used in lots of places. And what we could also advertise is that we are not just some license that we stick to some code that nobody wants to see, but actually our mailing list has some 200, our development mailing list has some 200 subscribers, and is rooted in various, has done various projects already in the Python world. And so this is what we said, is this is a true project, true open source project, not just some license attached to some code. And then what we could do, because we are not doing Java, is that we said governments in the EU, we knew that they use Python, and especially ZOAP, that is based on Python, a lot. So we could stress the relevance of this European technology invented by the Dutch Guido van Rossum and all this with respect. Okay, he's now in the States. We didn't mention that, I think. And it isn't really, I mean, we are working with people from the States and everything, so it doesn't really make that much sense, but still we kind of used this point. And of course, we also described all the people involved in the project, the personal people, the individual physical persons, and described that they are really able to do this project. And also one thing that is of interest to them is agile development methods. Especially this word agile is appearing in lots of places, also in the EU. Maybe because they want to have some kind of, I don't know, they recognize their large bureaucracy and they want to have some agility and know how to do that also, I don't know. Anyway, these are the points that we kind of filtered out that were selling points for the EU. A word about our development process. I mentioned that a bit, and that's what we presented to the EU. Everything is centered around 14 sprints that we are going to do in the next 2 years, all over the world, not just in Europe. And we are meeting there for 1 week to 2 weeks always. And all the decisions for the projects, also regarding the EU project, will be usually made on these sprints. And we hope that we can do a bottom-up management and decision process, like what is kind of usual in open source projects. That's kind of different to what the EU is used to, where they have a hierarchy which is more top-down. And we also promised that we will describe this process and analyze benefits and drawbacks and all this. So that's something I heard later that they are also interested to get reports and stuff on. What we learned the hard way is, now it gets a bit to finances. And that's a very, very difficult point. The EU only funds actual costs, and only 50% of them, usually. Apart from universities and, I didn't mention it here, non-profit associations. But like I said, non-profit associations have a high barrier to actually become eligible for funding. But if they do, they can also receive 100% funding. So if you have some kind of foundation or so, check with your national office if you can make it work, because then you might get 100% of your costs, of your actual costs, back. The actual cost thing is also the one that kills freelancers, because freelancers don't have actual costs. They cost something, like they charge someone else to give them money, but they themselves don't have costs. If you compare that to a company employs someone, and you have a company bank account, and from that account, you have costs for the employee, and that are real, actual costs. Freelancers don't have that, that's why they cannot get funded directly. That's what they say. I'm not saying this makes complete sense or something, it's just the system they're using. So for many of us, that meant that we have to found companies employing ourselves. Or, as some others do, work through a university. Find a professor or someone else at a research institute that wants to employ you for the project, which is good for them, some reputation, some money. But all in all, the 50% rule for companies is a problem, obviously. So what we did, founding the companies, is well, we had a lot of interaction with the Chamber of Commerce. In German, that's Industrie- und Handelskammer. And they are really helpful. It's another regional institution in every city. And if you actually want to found a company, go there. They don't charge any money for advising you. And they usually have for every department, legal, financial, all this, even sometimes EU stuff, they have people advising you. And it's a lot nicer than I thought before. What remains open if you do found a company is, where do you get co-financing? Well, we were lucky in some ways because we had the possibility, we knew some people who would give the companies a private loan. And if so, the other 40 to 50% for the company are coming as a loan that has to be paid back later. But that this means that you can pay salaries at 100% to the person, get 50, actually a bit more than 50% back from the EU, or even in advance. It's not really back, you get it in advance. And later on, you have to worry how your company actually can pay back the loan. But if it's low interest and you have, well, I think we have some 5 to 7 years to pay that back, then this works. And I think it would have been possible actually to go for what I mentioned earlier, for this regional bank to do something similar. And they may even give you no interest loans and so on. So that's a model. I'm not saying this is really the perfect model. I think trying to somehow get for open source projects, get 100% funding makes more sense, but it's not easily possible. So this is one solution. And I think the association, the non-profit association one, is also another good solution. But it has to be done. I mean, somebody has to do it. And I think there are some associations who succeeded, so that should be explored. Well, one of the things that we experienced a lot is we had to hurry up. The EU would say, you have 2 weeks to send in new documents. And then we had to wait. 1 week, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. And then we got an answer. You have to submit in 20 days this and that. So it's this hurry up to wait. I mean, we have to hurry up and then we have to wait. Long time. Anyway, changing the whole structure, and you have to be prepared for this kind of thing, this insecurity that you don't know how it actually plays out and all this, that obviously is difficult. Changing the structure, founding the companies and some other changes, people moving from one university to another and all this, led to a modified kind of final consortium in August 2004, like 5 months ago. And then it took 2.5 months for them to process that, and they did actually sign the contract with our project on the 30th of November, which means that the project is in effect 1st of December this year, so just this month actually. Before they sign, they will tell you, actually I don't need to tell you because they will tell you hundreds of times that before the signature is there, you have no legal certainty, no guarantees whatsoever. They have to tell you this because otherwise you could sue them and then they lose their 2 year salary and all this. So, and we came to the conclusion that usually no news is good news. If they have something to, if they don't say anything, then that's usually good news. If they like respond after 3 weeks, that can mean that they have something that you have to change something. Of course, I'm only talking of from experiences from my project and the projects of some friends. So your mileage may vary. How does it go on now? 1st of December it starts. We have funding now for 2 years. And of course, the formal work, the formal procedures don't end. We will have to write reports. And we have some people caring for that. But overall, everybody of us has to write some of the reports. And also you have to, what I didn't write down here is you have to keep time. They want at some point, they want audit certificates. And that's something they introduced with the framework program 6, the current one from 2002 to 2006. And they will probably use the same audit certificate requirement in the next framework program. And that means that everybody who participates in an EU project has to go to an auditor, to a person, in German Wirtschaftsprüfer, who actually certifies that that you spent and that you incurred, that you told the EU the correct costs. So he may go through your books and say, okay, you did everything correctly, and give you a certificate, and you have to give this certificate from an independent auditor to the EU. They require this. They changed, they didn't do that in Framework Program 5, and some of you may remember that in the end of the 90s there were big corruption cases in the EU. I think even the research commissioner from, what was it, France or so, Edith something, she had to resign for all these hundreds of millions of corruption. Pardon? Edith Cresson, yeah. But I don't really know too much about it, but yes, there was a question? Sorry? Do they pay for? Yes, they do pay for, the question was, do they pay for the audit certificate? And they do pay for the audit certificate, I think at 100%. So that doesn't really need to bother you to get to someone. And the costs for such an audit certificate, depending on your organization, range from, as far as we know, 1,000 to 3,000 euros. But that's paid by the budget. So these audit certificates are a requirement, and actually what you can count on is that the EU treats the consortium a bit like a bank that gives you a loan or something. So they make each partner in the consortium liable. They want certificates that all the companies are all right and not just on the verge of bankruptcy and all this. So they're behaving very similar to what banks do nowadays. And one of our main open questions is, how do we get sprint participants to get funding? Physical persons, like I said, freelancers count as physical persons, individuals. They can get 100% funding, but only for their additional costs. And that means additional costs, not additional costs, for their indirect costs. And that means travel, accommodation, buying a computer, all this. Everything that is basically not work cost, you could say. So you can get, we want to make this possible, that we can invite people, especially if we are going to meet, I think in March in Washington and then sometime in South Korea and all this, then obviously for many people it's not possible to go there if they don't have some kind of funding. And we want to make this possible somehow. It's not clear yet how we can do that. So this is a picture from our meeting, middle of this month, our first real consortium meeting in real life. And there are companies from Sweden, University of Düsseldorf, and Logilab from Paris, and so on. You can read that. And these are the organizations. A consortium consists of organizations, but an open source project, or an open source project, consists of people. And these are the contributors, I think, up to, I don't know, June this year or so. There are more now. And these are people, individuals, really, contributing and working with the project. And half of them are not in any of these organizations. So there's, and that's, I think, it's probably going, I mean, that's for any real open source project, that's how it's going to happen. That you have some people who get paid for something and others not. That's obviously a problem. And what we're going to do is, like I said, we want to get other people get funded for travel and all this, and also we want to set up some kind of private fund where everybody gives some of the money that he gets privately so that you can fund some more people if they need the money. And of course, we also want to keep the decision and the whole development process between the people. So the consortium is going to play a role only if we are critical, in a critical state, reaching our goals that we promised to the EU. And otherwise, we are just going to try to make this happen out of the project. And of course, the people being employed and receiving EU funding will have a special responsibility to make the deliverables and the goals we promised to the EU and the milestones happen. Nevertheless, the consortium is the one signing the contract with the European Union. And it does make sense. There's a certain provision. It's not for these special targeted resource project STRAPs. It's not necessary that you do that, but it does make sense that the organization signs some kind of contract, because each of the partners is, irrespective of the contract, is fully liable with their whole funding amount. And that means if any of these companies messes up, like gets the money but does nothing for some reason, or there are other problems, the others are liable. It doesn't need to be their mistake. That's also a change from Framework Program 5, where the EU basically talked to each partner, had a relation to each partner directly. Now they have a relation to the whole consortium, and they can make everybody liable for the whole thing, but only up to their full individual funding amount, not more. But obviously this can be a lot, so that is a problem, especially for newly funded, founded companies. And of course, the EU model agreements, another term you can find with Google easily, and model contracts, they do not fit open source projects at all. Not at all, but well, many important parts don't fit, and especially the ones about so-called intellectual property rights and communication don't fit at all. I mean, that's completely top down. It's completely closed. I think one of the paragraphs about communication in the model contract says that if you want to do any communication to anybody outside the consortium, which is in our case almost everybody, if you want to do any communication, then you have to send a request to all the other consortium partners and give them 30 days to reply. And if they object, then you have to modify and all this. And it may take a decision from the coordinator and all this. And if you think about it, every communication, it really says every communication. And that means if you want to send some inquiry to some mailing list asking for something, that basically falls under this consortium agreement. So that doesn't make any sense. And for open source projects, at least, and I think not for any other kind of project, by the way. But so we kind of like these were, and also you have lots of talk about patents and all this, and that was like intellectual property rights and communication had like 10 pages of legalese with all kind of strange procedures, and in our version of the contract, it has, I think, the both together have half a page. I mean, our communication rules are everybody is free to communicate to whoever else. That's it. And of course, I noticed now, I think in the last weeks or so, there are other open source projects. They haven't been so public, that's why we didn't really get to know them. But especially in the last year, I think there were some projects, two or three, approved from the EU, and they also have consortium contracts. One of them is finalizing right now their consortium contract, and they are GPL based. Our stuff is all BSD based, BSD license based. But it's now you have kind of a choice to look at different models, and it's certainly possible to request from these projects their contracts and all this. It can save you a lot of time and money. I think we spent some 10,000 euros or so alone on asking consultants to check certain stuff and rules and all this. Other lessons in the project, it makes a lot of sense if you employ very transparent communication. I mentioned the coordinator problem. Make sure you have everybody knows what's going on all the time. Especially, many of you may know that if money is involved, even between good-minded people, it can get difficult. And transparency is one of the things that makes it easier to communicate and not start to think very bad things about other people. And then also something that is not in the EU regulations. Think how you can manage your project and make decisions in a bottom-up way. That's the usual way, and it's not easy to get this, to connect this to the EU, but I think it's possible. And I cannot tell if what we are doing is really going to succeed. Well, meet me next year or something. But I think it makes sense to invest some thought in how you do this, especially if you have some people in your project that know about management, organizational models, and all this. And of course, I'm going to stress this another time, reach out for help. It makes a lot of sense. It can, I mean, some of the stuff you can investigate for 2 months, and somebody, if you find the right person, explains it to you in 10 minutes. So do look around on the web, and go to your national offices and all this. And then one of the things we also learned the hard way, one of the things that your project officer can check immediately is consistency. The documents that you are delivering, for example, your work planning on how you plan your work for the next 2 years, and the descriptions of the work and all this. This has to be very consistent, because that's one of the things, even without any technical knowledge, they can spot that. And that's the thing they first check. So make sure that the documents that you deliver, that you proofread them, and that they are consistent, especially in the numbers that you deliver. Don't ask for funding somewhere for 1.2 million and somewhere else for 1.1 million. That's not going to look good to the EU. And that's something that everybody can check in the EU. So, like I said, now I'm just making them bold. If you enter a combination of any of these keywords, you will find a lot of more information, especially from your national bureaus. And I guess it makes sense to look for your nationalized version in German. If you just enter EU Büro, you get to the government-funded EU office. And well, I think. I don't know, I haven't really talked to the other EU open source projects so far directly, but I think it would be great if we somehow got together and set up a website where we have some consortium models and so on, and try to learn some lessons and so on together. Well, thanks for listening, and thanks to some people for proofreading this. You can download this talk, and I'm waiting for questions. Yeah?
But is your project a pure open source project, or do some of the participants plan to make a living out of the results?
Yes.
One of the ideas of such projects would be that later on employment gets created and European economy also benefits.
Yes, right. Well, the point is there's no contradiction between an open source project and commercially exploiting it. And one of the reasons we are doing a BSD license is, which means you can do whatever you like with it. You can sell it commercially, you can do it, well, whatever you like, basically. And that means that everybody in our consortium, as well as everybody outside, can use what we do and further develop it and sell it. For example, some people are thinking in our group of doing some special gaming engine, because gaming engines using AI logic and all this, they want to have some script language where they can actually quickly draw up some character movements and all this, and you can sell that actually. So everybody is explicitly free to use it commercial in any way.
And some of the partners plan to do it.
Yes. Well, I have ideas about how to do that, but well, obviously it makes more sense to go for to wait a bit how we succeed.
You said there was one single point of contact, coordinator or something like that, and you said you should contact your local EU office.
Yes.
But this coordinator is the one that knows the details of your project.
This coordinator is, I mean, a coordinator of an EU project is supposed to know a lot because he should have done EU projects, but as the framework programs are changing all the time, you cannot expect, and I personally didn't experience that, you cannot expect coordinators to know all about this, especially because open source projects and like little companies and all this are not their expertise. The usual open source, sorry, the usual EU project where you have coordinators for are coming from universities. So they have a bit of a different view. And if you are working through a university, then you usually have someone in your university knowing about this because they have done it 100 times already. So.
What is the smallest project where FP6 funding makes sense? We've heard of a lot of overhead, a lot of bureaucracies going on. So in terms of lines of code or in terms of numbers of developers involved, how large does a project have to be?
I think there are projects with just like 3 or 4 people. So you can go for $500,000 or for like, depends, like, yeah. You can go for any kind of project, and I said there are these special targeted research projects. There are also some other instruments, how they are called, which is, for example, Network of Excellence, which works completely differently. It's rather new, where everybody kind of flatly gets some €5,000 for doing certain things for half a year, and so there are different types of projects, and I think anything below 100,000 in this type of framework Program 6, I wouldn't believe that it's possible. And what you read on websites from the EU is they say 1 to 3 million, but I think $500,000 is also quite possible. We can talk about this later because I think it's ending now. Okay, thanks again.